Hi, listeners. It's Dr. Risa E. Lewis dropping in to thank you. Thanks to all of you for joining and supporting us in our book journey. I'm so glad to share that Microskills was selected as a next Big Idea Club must read for April 2024. Microskills, small actions, big impact. Order now wherever you buy your books.
Writing a prescription for a rent subsidy that allows a family to have more access to safe, decent, and affordable housing. That's the cure-all. And sorry, pharmaceutical industry, it's not going to be a pill that fixes it. It is literally having access to a safe space and an environment that fosters good health. And it's consistent with our belief that housing can be and should be a platform for economic mobility for families. I think housing is at the root of so much. I fully believe that if my family did not have access to safe, decent, affordable housing through the HUB subsidy that we were able to have, it would have completely changed the trajectory of my life.
This is the Visible Voices podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Risa Lewis. In today's episode, I speak with Marquita Morris-Louis. Oui, je parle français. Marquita and I first met through Brown University, the Women's Leadership Council. And I was super glad when she joined, as up to that date, I was the sole person coming in from Philadelphia. Marquita is the CEO of Compass Working Capital. As means of background, she's a Philadelphian. She attended Brown University, then NYU Law School, and her career has spanned many boards, many companies, many organizations, and she's what I call a cross-trainer, cross-professional. She's worn many hats. She does it really well. And today we're going to be focusing the conversation on asset building and low-income housing and health and so much more. Let's get to the conversation. You're a cross-sectional leader. I'm going to list some of the hats you've worn, some of the roles you've played in this book that is the chapter of your life. So you attended undergraduate at Brown University. You focused on Africana studies and anthropology. You participated in theater, Rights and Reasons Theater. And
yes. Reasons, it's funny. I don't think a ton of people know that about me and know that part of my history and background. So I'm having a moment. Like, I feel like this is your life.
So I think then we should stop in this moment and say, do you want to share a little bit more about what you did with Rights and Reasons?
Yeah. Oh man. Rights and Reasons was such a magical time in my life. When I was coming up, I was always interested in kind of music, theater, and dance. We didn't always have the resources for me to participate in those activities. And so when I got to Brown and discovered this amazing place, Rights and Reasons Theater, which is the third oldest continually operating African-American centered theater in the country, I was just blown away, and more particularly by Elmo Terry Morgan, who's a professor at Brown, recently retired, and the creative director of Rights and Reason. And it just opened me up to so much. And it was just a sanctuary and a home for me and a space for all this creative expression. So, you know, I participated in plays, acted in plays. I also choreographed some plays and got to meet amazing folks on campus who were actors, but also what was so great about Rights and Reason and Elmo Terry Morgan is that, you know, they were able to attract and bring folks from the community. Elmo had deep connections in New York City through his days with the National Black Theater. So he was able to bring actors with a ton of experience for students to engage with. So I just met some of the most incredible people who had profound impacts on my life and my time there. Like, I often say that, you know, I'm from Philly. I was born and raised in Philly, but I really grew up at Brown and at Rights and Reason.
You and I share that in common in feeling the magic. More on your hats and your cross-sectional professionalism. Arts and Business Council of Greater Philadelphia. You've done work in real estate law. You have a law degree from NYU. Impact litigation and community development, advocacy for fair lending, housing and employment practices, and supporting affordable housing transactions. Why housing?
That's a great question. I think I've always been fascinated by the circumstances that created segregation in our country, and placemaking. So at one point, I lived in HUD subsidized housing. I grew up mostly in HUD subsidized housing. And I lived in project-based Section 8 community in North Philadelphia. And directly across the street was a public housing community called Richard Allen, named after the founder of the first African Methodist Episcopal Church in Philadelphia and the, you know, abolitionist Richard Allen. And it was not lost on me that some of the toughest places with the least opportunity and the most neglected communities were often named after the most amazing, trailblazing people. You know, Martin Luther King Boulevard is a joke in the Black community that every Martin Luther King Boulevard is in the hood. I'm just speaking very plainly here. So I was fascinated by the idea that my community was directly across from a public housing community and we're all receiving subsidy, but there was a stark difference in the structure of the buildings. We were living in kind of garden style apartments versus a lot of high rises within the public housing community. We would have grass rolled out for a playground and it wasn't great. You know, it was a steel playground that when it overheated in the summer, it would burn your legs, but it was still, you know, that was our sliding board, but we still had access to a playground and some kind of amenities and the public housing community directly across the street there. So I was fascinated by that as a kid. I didn't have the vocabulary. I didn't have the understanding of the forces that shape these housing types, but it was just something that interested me. So when I got to college, I, you know, took a little time to explore that. And in law school is really where I started to understand what community development was and what that meant, or actually the time between college and law school. I was working in DC and started to explore issues of fair housing and community development.
Yeah. Can you go a little bit more into definitions of public housing versus subsidized housing?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Department of Housing and Urban Development, our federal agency that oversees the development and preservation of affordable housing in this country, has intermediaries at the local level, public housing authorities. They are usually at the city level. So large cities will have one, some regions have them, some counties have them. And they are how the Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, kind of disperses resources at the local level. Public housing authorities provide vouchers to individual households to allow them to supplement the cost of market-based rent. That's one form of subsidy. And another way they deliver kind of housing assistance is by building on communities. And a lot of public housing was built just after World War II, or just before or after World War II in this country. So there's a lot of aging housing stock. And project-based Section 8, where I grew up, is how HUD involves the private sector. So they allow private owners or developers of affordable housing to get access to resources that flow through the public housing authorities. And they can then use those resources to build subsidized communities with below market rents. And so that's a trying to paint a very succinct picture of a relatively complex ecosystem.
Yeah. Subject Matter Expertise by Marquita. It's great.
Risa, it's fascinating. I got the opportunity to meet some representatives of the owners of the community that I grew up in. And I don't know, I got kind of emotional. And this is why I love this work, because I have such a strong personal connection to it. And to be able to both have the lived experience and to, you know, have some knowledge in the language to articulate what it means to live in these spaces, to preserve these spaces, to create more opportunities for families. And then this is a gift. It's just an absolute privilege to be able to do this work for me.
I think now is a perfect time. So I'm a Rhode Islander without the Rhode Island accent, I tell people, but a New Englander. And so growing up, you know, the sports teams to which we gravitated were generally Boston. Sometimes mm-hmm. it was New York. But you have had a long commitment to Philadelphia as a city. So maybe listeners who don't quite understand the Philly love, can you give any insight?
Oh, yeah. Philly is such an interesting city. You know, it's often referred to as a big city with a small town feel. It's definitely a city of neighborhoods. Like, you rep your neighborhood big time in Philly. it has a strong sense of identity because it's with a chip on its shoulder, trying to, you know, constantly say, we're not New York. That's the biggest thing Philadelphians will tell you. And there's this kind of love-hate relationship, mostly hate relationship with New York. And it's probably a sense of inferiority that we're constantly trying to overcome. Because I think in the kind of early days of the American experiment, Philadelphia was the center of commerce and governance and politics, and then started to lose its way to DC and New York and Boston and other cities. But that also makes Philly special because folks have a strong sense of identity and self. You can see it in our sports teams. We have just this awful reputation of being way too much and doing way too much as fans, particularly when the Eagles are playing. It's a whole thing. I get wrapped up in it too. The Eagles are responsible for a lot of, I feel like I've had like episodes of high blood pressure and I just can't watch the games. I'll watch a full recap knowing the outcome because it's better for me to know the outcome.
So funny.
Even when I got to Brown, I think people were surprised at my accent and some of the language I use. Like Philadelphia, we call fire hydrants water plugs. And oh my gosh, like I got so many jokes about that, particularly from my New Yorker friends who were just like, what? And they expected me to sound exactly like them. And when I did, and there was a lot of surprise there. So, oh yeah, it's been important for me to maintain my kind of figurative Philadelphia accent and to kind of show up and that identity in all the spaces I've been fortunate enough to occupy in my career.
I'm Dr. Risa E. Lewis, dropping in to tell you about a book that Dr. Adair Landry and I wrote. It's called Microskills, Small Actions, Big Impact. It's a business self-help book being published in April of 2024 by HarperCollins. We believe every future goal, complicated task, and healthy habit can be broken down into simple, measurable, and tiny skills that you can practice and then excel by removing obstacles, overcoming assumptions, and maximizing your potential at work and in life. You can pre-order it now. Go to bookshop.org, amazon.com, or wherever you buy your books. Social determinants of health are the conditions in the environment where people are born, live, learn, work, play, worship, and age that affect a wide range of health, functioning, and quality of life outcomes and risks. They're generally grouped into five domains: economic stability, education access and quality, healthcare access and quality, neighborhood and built environment, social and community context. So this starts to bring into focus this concept of housing and social determinants of health. Mm-hmm. In September of this year, you participated in the Boston Medical Center's Health Equity 2023, a summit for health justice. And so I'm wondering if you can go deeper into this connection with the work you do, housing and health.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I'll even expand it beyond housing to economic mobility and health. So it's interesting, Risa, this journey for me started actually years ago when I was working at a HUD certified housing counseling agency, doing work around foreclosure prevention and home ownership and just kind of financial stability for families in Greater Philadelphia. And we had actually started a medical financial partnership looking at the ways that a lot of healthcare decisions were financial decisions and supporting families and making those decisions. You know, we also were inspired by some early research by some professors here at Penn who were doing work around the health impacts of families who were going through mortgage foreclosure and showed that in addition to kind of psychological impacts and emotional trauma-based impacts, folks were experiencing serious conditions of stress that obviously had an overall impact on their health. And that folks who were experiencing deep financial challenge were not able to even engage with the healthcare system, were not taking prescribed medications because they couldn't afford it. So there's so much evidence for the intersection between those things. And I don't know why it's taken so long for us to recognize that and operationalize solutions around it. So why I was at that summit and why I think I was invited by Dr. Thea James at Boston Medical Center, someone we both hold in high esteem, and I'm just like fortunate to have her as a member of my board of directors at Compass, it's that you cannot begin to talk about changing people's health or leading folks toward better health outcomes without addressing the physical conditions that create poor health outcomes. It's fun for me to be around healthcare providers and kind of listen to their language and be able to see the places of intersection, you know, the linkages between, again, financial stress and physical health outcomes are really, really powerful. I appreciate that now the healthcare system is thinking about how it can bring in additional resources that help folks have better living conditions that support their positive health outcomes. Writing a prescription for a rent subsidy that allows a family to have more access to safe, decent, affordable housing. That's the cure-all. And sorry, pharmaceutical, you know, industry, is not going to be a pill that fixes it. It is literally having access to a safe space and an environment that fosters good health. And it's consistent with our belief that housing can be and should be a platform for economic mobility for families. I think housing is at the root of so much. And again, just to take it back to my personal life, I fully believe that if my family did not have access to safe, decent, affordable housing through the HUB subsidy that we were able to have, it would have completely changed the trajectory of my life.
Yeah. Do you think people understand all the interrelatedness of all these factors?
I don't know. I don't know if there's a full appreciation for it. I think we're all, those of us who do this work, are doing a better job of trying to lift it up, elevate it, make it a lot more visible, and also speak just more plainly about these intersections. I do feel like I'm seeing it more in the spaces where I operate, particularly around housing. I sit on the board of the Pennsylvania Housing Finance Agency, and the PHFA has been doing a lot of work around the intersection of health and housing more recently, and funding housing innovation grants, which I'm really excited about, and thinking about how can we allow placemaking to support strong health outcomes. And I think initially it was seen maybe with young children because of lead exposure and mold and the connection there with asthma. And it was also seen with the elderly in terms of allowing folks to age in place in a more cost-effective and community-focused manner. I think we're just starting to scratch the surface around everybody in between and what that means, frankly, for all of us. All of us are kind of living at the intersection of health and housing.
One more focus question about Compass Working Capital. There's something called FSS, the Family Self-Sufficiency Program. And it sounds like, from what I've read, there's nothing like it in the country. What is it and what makes it different, sustainable, and impactful?
I will say that it is HUD's only, and I might get chastised by saying only, but certainly largest and most impactful asset building program. The way it works is that it allows families who live in HUD-assisted housing to basically convert rent payments into savings. Families in HUD-assisted housing typically pay a portion of their income towards rent. It's 30% of their income is determined to be their rent payment because we've decided in this country that that's a threshold of affordability. So when their income goes up, they experience a proportionate increase in rent. So I'm paying $200 in rent. I get a raise. I get a new job. I get a promotion. Now my rent is $500. And that can feel like a marginal tax on increases in earned income, right? The rest of us who don't live in subsidized housing, we get to keep whatever we earn, but families have to pay more in rent. Now, the problem with that is that families are often losing other income-based benefits as they pay more in rent. So I'm paying more in rent, but now my food benefit may be impacted. My childcare benefit may be impacted. And oftentimes that higher income is not enough to overcome the loss of all those benefits and the fact that I have to pay more in rent. So that creates a challenge. And this is why the lives of folks who are interacting with the social safety net are so complex, because they're constantly making these structurally constrained choices, right? And there's a whole conversation that I want to have around like just the lack of radical empathy in our country, but I'm going to put that to the side for now. And then FSS, what FSS tries to do is kind of interrupt this process or disrupt it. Because when families go from paying that $200 to $500 in rent, and this is just an example, the housing provider saves the difference. They save $300 in an account for them every single month for up to around 5 years. So that $300 times 12 months times 5 years is $18,000. So there's no other program like that that allows families to build savings over time through a process that they're already undertaking, through payments they're already required to make, and it doesn't require them to try to divert funds from their own income, which most families don't have the ability to do. So frankly, I'm critical of savings programs that are just telling people with low incomes, you need to budget and save. That is so disrespectful, and it just does not acknowledge the complexity of their lives and all the different impacts that, you know, are happening on their income. So FSS, folks are both increasing their income, they're increasing savings. Compass has built a model of it that is really focused on assets. FSS was initially designed as a workforce program to encourage or incentivize families in HUD-assisted housing to work more so they could reduce their dependence on subsidy. We've kind of shifted the model to really focus on just the savings opportunity. It's a huge engine and accelerant for families to save. And that $18,000, for example, they're using for a down payment on a home. They are paying off debt, increasing their credit scores. They're saving for their education or for their children's education. They're starting businesses. And sometimes they're just happy to have emergency savings in the bank as they prepare for the next calamity or they think about trying to invest in their future. So folks are building both sums that allow them to weather financial storms and also investable sums that allow them to think ahead to the future. Because when you have a low income and you're interacting with the social safety net and experiencing poverty, you are so focused on the here and now and you're thriving. You can't lift your head up and think about the future and survive. And so this is why we're so focused on scaling both the impact and the opportunity for families to participate in this program.
Your love for this, for FSS, for the work, for the impact of this program is just visible and audible and palpable. And I feel so lucky to be having this conversation with you.
Thank you, Risa. My love is more for the problem of poverty and poverty alleviation. And I'm just interested in solutions that could work. And the fact that we have a shovel ready, I refer to it as a shovel ready solution, that's been around since 1990, 33 years, but we haven't really scratched the surface. We estimate that there are well over 2 million families that could benefit from this opportunity, but only about 65,000 are currently enrolled in the program. And we are working to change that from a direct service perspective. We're supporting housing authorities and other HUD providers to expand the access to the program. And we're also doing a lot of work on the policy side to reduce barriers for families who want to participate.
Your voice. When did you realize you had a voice? And when did you start using your voice?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. I don't know. I've always been someone who fairness is really important to me. And people being treated with consideration has always been important to me as a kid. I think because I spent so much time with my grandparents, maybe my grandparents were amazing people. My grandfather had a fourth grade education. My grandmother, eighth grade education. They're from Alabama, grew up in the 20s and 30s. You can imagine what their lives were like. They were living under a system of constant terrorism. And then they made the decision to flee, and they were part of the Great Migration and came up north in the 50s. And, you know, they weren't particularly welcomed here either, but they were kind, good-hearted people who just thought about fairness and taught me to just be fair and considerate and kind. And so at the root of kind of my voice is this, like, I get angered. I get pissed off by things that just don't feel fair and kind and right. It's a sort of not a righteous indignation, I'm just pissed off all the time. And James Baldwin said, like, if you're not angry all the time, then you don't know what's happening in America. And so I think it was probably in high school where I realized that I had something to say and I could say something and maybe somebody would listen. And running for, you know, student government president, and I was the first student to sit on the Board of Education in Philly. And there were a lot of folks who were trying to shut me up then, who just didn't believe that a student should have access to that kind of power, even though I was a non-voting member, but I could bring things up and bring things to the floor. And I often did. And I learned then that sometimes you didn't have to or couldn't wait for permission, right? I look to inspirational people like Shirley Chisholm, who says, and I actually have her quote on my wall right behind me, that, you know, if you're not getting a seat at the table, you pull up a folding chair. And so I try to exercise that whenever possible and hold that close to me and impart that same kind of spirit to my children.
Your legacy.
My children are absolutely my legacy. And, you know, I want them to have the same sense of dissatisfaction with the way things are, but to also be able to articulate a vision for the way things can be and to take the action necessary to make it possible. You know, I'm not interested in just kind of talking. I'm a very action-oriented person. So this is why I work in a direct service organization. I love that we're doing work on the ground. We're supporting families directly, and we're trying to shape policy, trying to create the landscape, the environment that we want, that's necessary for families with low incomes to be able to thrive. Yeah, I hope that's part of my legacy.
The Risa wrap-up. Special thanks to Marquita Morris-Louis for joining me in conversation. I appreciate your time, your energy, your heart, your brain, all of it. Audience, I'm going to read to you a bit of summary of some of the content that we covered so it can really drive home why all of this, meaning the work that Marquita and her company is doing, makes sense. First, let's talk about assets and economics and mobility. Assets are a stronger predictor than income of financial well-being and economic mobility. Asset ownership is also associated with improved educational outcomes for children, including higher high school and college graduation rates, a decrease in the intergenerational transfer of poverty, and a more hopeful and positive orientation towards the future. Assets, therefore, are also associated with better health. Next, our nation's anti-poverty programs. Now, many of you may push back on this concept and might be a little skeptical, but believe you me, this concept of institutional racism and structural racism is baked into many of our country's institutions. Our nation's anti-poverty programs have historically done very little to support families with low incomes to build assets. In the United States, we have historically measured and addressed poverty in terms of income, hence the reason to think about assets rather than income. And finally, the CEO of Compass Working Capital, Marquita Morris-Louis. This woman is one to watch. And that's all I have for you this week, audience. See you next time. The Visible Voices podcast amplifies voices both known and unknown, discussing topics of healthcare, equity, and current trends. We are a production of the People's Media Network. Our team includes Dr. Giuliano DePortu and me, Dr. Risa E. Lewis. Please find me on social media at Risa E. Lewis and through the website, thevisiblevoicespodcast.com. If you like the podcast, please rate and review us. Share the podcast with a friend today. Thank you so much for listening, and as always, to be continued.
Do you know there's research that women that attend women conferences are more likely to have a promotion or a raise in the next year? Imagine if you could also attend a retreat in California and enjoy some sunshine and beach time. That's what we've put together for you April 5th through 7th in Huntington Beach, California. Visit peoplealwayshcc.com/revitalize-retreat to learn more.